With hope and ended with tragedy, Kennedy set the nation on a path, not to peace, but to war. In the world stage struggle between communism and capitalism, Kennedy was determined to win over third world countries that remained, even if only nominally, uncommitted. In 1951, eyeing a run for the Senate, Kennedy and his brother Bobby had made a 7-week tour of Asia and the Middle East, stopping in Vietnam. Long colonized by the French and occupied by the Japanese beginning in 1940, Vietnam, led by communist revolutionary Ho Chi Minh, the man who tried to meet with Wilson at the Paris Peace Conference in 1919, had declared its independence at the end of the Second World War. But France had launched a campaign to restore colonial rule. The United States viewed the spread of communism in Southeast Asia with alarm, chiefly for ideological reasons, but geopolitical and economic factors played a role too. China and the USSR were plainly in the best position to exert influence in Southeast Asia with its population of 170 million, but every Southeast Asian country that became part of the communist bloc threatened a loss of trade for Japan, which had already lost its trading relationship with China, its largest trading partner. The United States, attempting to exert its own influence in the region, redirected its foreign aid from Europe to Asia and Africa. Between 1949 and 1952, three-quarters of American aid went to Europe. Between 1953 and 1957, three-quarters went to the Third World. By 1962, nine-tenths did. When Indochina began attempting to overthrow French colonial rule, the United States supported France. The United States had been much admired after the war because of FDR's staunch opposition to colonialism. Its aid to France led to growing anti-Americanism. France lost the war in 1954. A treaty divided independent Vietnam at the 17th parallel. Ho Chi Minh and the Communist Party came to power in the north, and U.S.-backed Catholic nationalist Ngo Dinh Diem in the south. Beginning in 1955, South Vietnam became the site of the largest state-building experiment in the world, training a police force and civil servants, building bridges, roads, and hospitals, under the advice of the Michigan State University Vietnam Advisory Group. In 1958, Kennedy was among a group of senators who handed out to every colleague a copy of Burdick and Lederer's The Ugly American, which told the story of American diplomats and military men stationed in the fictional Asian country of Sarkhan, lost in a mire of misunderstanding and failure. In a factual epilogue, Lederer and Burdick reported a rising tide of anti-Americanism around the world, arguing that the United States could hardly hope to wield political influence when, for one thing, American ambassadors to Asia did not speak the language. In the whole of the Arabic world, nine nations, only two ambassadors have language qualifications. In Japan, Korea, Burma, Thailand, Vietnam, Indonesia, and elsewhere, our ambassadors must speak and be spoken to through interpreters. Notwithstanding Burdick and Lederer's caution, the U.S. government escalated its involvement when, by the late 1950s, a communist insurgency had begun in the South. Many people in Vietnam viewed the 1,500 American researchers and advisors in South Vietnam as an early signal that the United States hoped to place Vietnam under its own colonial rule, even though by 1960, the American military presence consisted of only 685 American troops. Kennedy understood Vietnam through the lens of modernization schemes endorsed by intellectuals, and above all, by MIT's Walt Rostow, whose Stages of Economic Growth, 1960, helped convince Kennedy to commit more resources to Vietnam. Rostow's MIT friend and colleague, Ithiel de Sola Poole, having helped get Kennedy elected, turned to the project of using the tools of simulmatics to help modernize South Vietnam. Convinced that with enough data, a computer could simulate an entire social and political system, Poole would eventually earn a $24 million contract from ARPA for a multi-year research project in Vietnam. Modernizing South Vietnam meant building roads and airstrips, but guaranteeing the security of those roads and airstrips required sending and training soldiers because the South Vietnamese were engaged in a war with North Vietnam. By the end of 1963, after Ngo Dinh Diem was murdered in a U.S.-sanctioned coup only 3 weeks before Kennedy was assassinated, 16,000 American troops were stationed in Vietnam. Eventually, winning the war became the mission. Meanwhile, Kennedy's administration came close to deploying a nuclear weapon in a nearly catastrophic confrontation with Cuba. Eisenhower's administration had developed a plan by which the United States would support an invasion of Cuba by forces opposed to Fidel Castro. Kennedy approved the plan, but in April 1961, Castro's army destroyed the forces that came ashore at the Bay of Pigs. The following summer, American U-2s flying over Cuba detected ballistic missiles capable of reaching the United States. They'd been sent by Khrushchev, the latest move in the worldwide Cold War game of chess. On October 22, 1962, in a televised address, Kennedy revealed the existence of the missiles and argued for action. "The 1930s taught us a clear lesson," he said. "Aggressive conduct, if allowed to go unchecked and unchallenged, ultimately leads to war." The Navy would quarantine Cuba. "It shall be the policy of this nation to regard any nuclear missile launched from Cuba against any nation in the Western Hemisphere as an attack by the Soviet Union on the United States, requiring a full retaliatory response upon the Soviet Union." 2 days later, 16 of 19 Soviet ships headed for the American naval blockade turned back. The Soviet premier then sent the White House two entirely different messages, one promising that it would withdraw its missiles from Cuba if the United States would end the blockade, the other saying something sterner. Urged by his advisors to ignore the second message, Kennedy responded to the first message. Khrushchev agreed to withdraw the missiles. As ever, Cold War confrontations abroad formed the backdrop for civil rights battles at home. To test the U.S. government's guarantee of desegregation and interstate transit, the Congress of Racial Equality, CORE, sent 13 trained volunteers, 7 blacks and 6 whites, the Freedom Riders, to ride 2 buses into and across the Deep South. The riders were mostly students like John Lewis, a theology student, who, although determined to finish his education, explained that at this time human dignity is the most important thing in my life. They left Washington, D.C. on May 4th. 2 days later, 35-year-old Robert Kennedy, the president's brother, gave his first public address as attorney general at the University of Georgia, throwing down a gauntlet to segregationists. "We will move. You may ask, will we enforce the civil rights statutes? The answer is yes, we will." That promise was soon challenged. 8 days later, in Anniston, Alabama, a white mob attacked the Greyhound bus on which one group of the Freedom Riders had been riding, shattering the windows, slashing the tires, and finally burning it. "Let's burn them alive!" the mob cried. The riders barely escaped with their lives. A Klan posse was waiting for the second bus when it arrived at a trailway station in Birmingham. Robert Kennedy ordered that the riders, badly beaten, be evacuated, but CORE decided to send in more riders, students from Nashville. Birmingham Police Commissioner Eugene Bull Connor had his troops meet them at the bus station and put them in jail before they could board the bus. There they were held without having been charged, while the state of Alabama dared the federal government to act. "As you know, the situation is getting worse in Alabama," the attorney general reported to the president. He convinced the president to call the governor of Alabama, Democrat John Patterson, who'd supported JFK's campaign in 1960. But Patterson, in a shocking act of defiance, refused to take the call. Before he'd become governor, Patterson, as the state's attorney general, had sought to block the NAACP from doing business. In 1958, he'd won the governor's office with the support of the KKK. Robert Kennedy sent an envoy to Montgomery to meet with the governor. "There's nobody in the whole country that's got the spine to stick up to the goddamn niggers except me," Patterson said to the man from the U.S. Justice Department. Told that if the state would not protect the riders, the president would send in federal troops, the governor reluctantly agreed to provide a police escort for the bus on its trip from Birmingham to Montgomery. But when the bus reached the station in Montgomery, another mob was waiting. John Lewis, the first off the bus, began speaking to a crowd of reporters and photographers, only to pause. "It doesn't look right," he whispered to another rider. Vigilantes hidden in the station emerged and began pummeling the press and setting upon the riders, attacking them with pipes, slugging them with fists, braining them with their own suitcases. When the badly beaten and bandaged Freedom Riders and 1,500 blacks met at the First Baptist Church next to Alabama State Capitol to decide what to do next, 3,000 whites surrounded the church, eventually to be dispersed by the Alabama National Guard. The Freedom Riders decided to keep on and rode all summer long. Even as 400 Freedom Riders were arrested in Mississippi and schoolchildren across the South were beaten at the doors of elementary schools, CORE and SNCC and King's Southern Christian Leadership Council continued to press for integration, pursuing a strategy of nonviolence. But they had to answer more and more to activists who favored separation and were willing to use force. Elijah Muhammad, the founder and prophet of the Nation of Islam, a Muslim movement begun in Detroit in the 1930s, had called for a black state. His most eloquent disciple, Malcolm X, had been criticizing King since the mid-1950s. He gained a new audience. Malcolm Little, who'd left a juvenile home in Michigan in 1941 to move in with his half-sister in Boston, had been arrested for armed robbery in 1945 when he was 20. During his 6 years in prison, he converted to Islam, studied Greek and Latin, and learned how to debate. "Once my feet got wet," he said, "I was gone on debating." Paroled in 1952, he'd gotten a department store job in Detroit and become one of Elijah Muhammad's most talented and devoted followers. Lecturing in Detroit in 1957, he'd drawn crowds 4,000 strong. And disobeying a Nation of Islam directive not to talk about electoral politics or even to register to vote, he'd asked, "What would the role and position of the Negro be if he'd had a full voting voice?" He'd also drawn the attention of the press, having been featured in The Hate That Hate Produced, a five-part 1959 documentary narrated by CBS News' Mike Wallace and reported by the African-American television journalist Louis Lomax. Appalled by the documentary, which he considered delusional to the point of inciting hysteria, Malcolm X compared it to Orson Welles' 1938 adaptation of The War of the Worlds. In the early 1960s, in a series of college-sponsored debates, Malcolm X had taken on integrationists. In 1961, as the Nation of Islam's national spokesman, he debated Bayard Rustin at Howard University and James Farmer, the head of CORE, at Cornell. Farmer, who had spent 40 days in jail during the Freedom Ride campaign, insisted on the importance of nonviolent struggle. But Malcolm X had little use for SNCC, CORE, and least of all, SCLC. "Anybody can sit," he liked to say. "It takes a man to stand." He first reached a national audience in 1962 after police in Los Angeles gunned down seven black Muslims, members of Mosque No. 27, a mosque Malcolm X had organized in the 1950s, who were loading dry cleaning into a car. Ronald X. Stokes, a Korean War veteran, was shot with both hands raised. Malcolm X, speaking at a rally, framed the killings in racial, not religious terms. "It's not a Muslim fight," he said. "It's a black man's fight." Many in the black community called for armed self-defense, the argument of Negroes with Guns, published in 1962. King, preaching Christianity and a sanctified democracy, lamented that black Muslims had lost faith in America. Meanwhile, white moderates urged SNCC, CORE, and SCLC to slow down. In one poll, 74% of whites, but only 3% of blacks, agreed with the statement, "Negroes are moving too fast." In April 1963, King led a protest in Birmingham, part of a long-planned campaign in the most violent city in the South. Of the more than 200 black churches and homes that had been bombed in the South since 1948, more bombs had gone off in Birmingham than in any other city. King had gone to Birmingham to get arrested, but found that support for his planned protest had ebbed. After white liberal clergymen denounced him in the Birmingham News, calling the protests untimely, King wrote a letter from jail in solitary confinement. He began writing in the margins of the newspaper, adding passages on slips of paper smuggled in by visitors. In the end, the letter reached 20 pages, a soaring piece of American political rhetoric, testament to the urgency of a cause. Perhaps it is easy for those who have never felt the stinging darts of segregation to say, "Wait," he conceded. But when you have seen vicious mobs lynch your mothers and fathers at will and drown your sisters and brothers at whim, when you have seen hate-filled policemen curse, kick, and even kill your black brothers and sisters, when you see the vast majority of your 20 million Negro brothers smothering in an airtight cage of poverty in the midst of an affluent society, then you will understand why we find it difficult to wait. George Wallace, Alabama's new governor, more or less answered that King would have to wait till hell froze. In June, Wallace said that if black students tried to enter the campus of the state university in Tuscaloosa, he'd block the door himself. Wallace, 43, ate politics for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. He slept politics, and he breathed politics, and he smoked politics. He'd been a page in the state senate in 1935 when he was 16. At the University of Alabama, he'd been both a star boxer and class president. After studying law, he'd served as an airman in the Pacific during the war. He ran for state Congress in 1946, the same year Nixon and Kennedy won seats in the U.S. House of Representatives. A loyal Southerner, he'd never been a particularly ardent segregationist. As an alternate at the 1948 Democratic Convention, he'd refused to bolt with the rest of the Dixiecrats. He'd endorsed Stevenson. But in 1958, running for governor with "Win with Wallace" as his motto, flanked by Confederate flags, he'd lost the Democratic primary to Patterson, who was more ardently opposed to desegregation. And as the story goes, Wallace had pledged to his supporters, "No other son of a bitch will ever out-nigger me again." In 1962, with a speechwriter who doubled as an organizer for the KKK, Wallace had won the governorship with 96% of the vote. In his inaugural in Montgomery, delivered a week before Kennedy was inaugurated in Washington, Wallace stood in the shadow of a statue of the President of the Confederacy, who'd been sworn in on that very spot. "Today I have stood where once Jefferson Davis stood and took an oath to my people," Wallace shouted. "And I say, segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever." He'd followed by meeting with educational leaders in the state and telling them, "If you agree to integrate your schools, there won't be enough state troopers to protect you." In May, when Kennedy celebrated his birthday, his staff gave him a pair of boxing gloves for his upcoming bout with the heavyweight from Alabama. But when the day came, on June 11th, Wallace gave in only 3 hours after the arrival of the National Guard. That afternoon, King telegrammed Kennedy that the Negro's endurance may be at the breaking point. Kennedy, who had been deliberating for months, went to Congress to meet with House members. He decided the time had come to speak to the public. On television that night, he addressed the nation. "If an American, because his skin is dark, cannot eat lunch in a restaurant open to the public, if he cannot send his children to the best public school available, if he cannot vote for the public officials who represent him, if, in short, he cannot enjoy the full and free life which all of us want, then who among us would be content to have the color of his skin changed and stand in his place?" He talked about military service. "When Americans are sent to Vietnam or to West Berlin, we do not ask for whites only." He invoked history. 100 years of delay have passed since President Lincoln freed the slaves, yet their heirs, their grandsons, are not fully free. And he asked Congress for new civil rights legislation. 100 years had been too long. No longer would Kennedy counsel patience. To mark the 100th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation, Bayard Rustin had been charged with planning a march on Washington, scheduled for August 1963. The Kennedy administration, worried about violence, had arranged for military troops to be kept on alert. The District of Columbia had canceled 2 Washington Senators baseball games. Some 300,000, the largest crowd ever gathered between the Lincoln Memorial and the Washington Monument, assembled on a cloudless summer's day. This sweltering summer of the Negroes' legitimate discontent, King called it. They came by bus and train and subway. One young man roller skated all the way from Chicago, wearing a sash that read, "Freedom." But Rustin had organized the march flawlessly, and by the time it was over, there would be only 4 march-related arrests. All arrested were white. SNCC chairman John Lewis, earnest and only 23, approached the microphone on the makeshift stage on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. He said he supported the proposed civil rights bill, but with great reservations, because there was so much that the federal government had failed to do at every turn. The crowd stirred each time he spoke his speech's refrain. "What did the federal government do?" Television stations that had cut away from earlier speeches resumed coverage when Martin Luther King rose to the stage. It was the first time most Americans had seen King deliver a speech. It was the first time that President Kennedy had ever seen King deliver an entire speech. He began by welcoming the greatest demonstration for freedom in the history of the nation, honoring Lincoln and the Emancipation Proclamation, and condemning the manacles of segregation and the chain of discrimination that still shackled blacks 100 years later. He spoke slowly and solemnly and formally. The Declaration of Independence and the Constitution were promissory notes, he said, a promise that all men would be guaranteed their rights. "It is obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note." It was stock stuff, delivered sternly, and loaded with sorrow. He cautioned the movement about the dangers of the marvelous new militancy, the loss of support of whites. He listed grievances. 10 minutes into his speech, his voice rising, he said, "We are not satisfied, and we will not be satisfied until justice rolls down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream." He looked down at the cumbersome next lines of his speech. "And so today, let us go back to our communities as members of the International Association for the Advancement of Creative Dissatisfaction," and left them unsaid. Instead, he began to preach. Mahalia Jackson, behind him on the platform, called out, "Tell him about the dream, Martin." He paused for an instant. "I still have a dream," he said. "It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. He found his rhythm and the depth of his voice and the spirit of Scripture. I have a dream today, he said, shaking his head. I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted. The crowd rose and bowed their heads and wept. Let freedom ring, he cried. It was as if every bell in every tower and every city and town and village had rung a toll of justice. 3 months later, Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas. Less than 5 years after that, King himself would be shot and killed in Memphis. By then, the dreams of American liberals had been felled in a hail of bullets and a trail of napalm bombs that rained down on the world from the streets of Newark and Detroit to the rice paddies of South Vietnam. The long arc of American liberalism that began with the inauguration of FDR in 1933 reached its peak and began its decline during the administration of LBJ. Roosevelt pursued a new deal. Truman promised a fair deal. Johnson talked about a better deal until he decided that made him sound like a footnote. He aimed for nothing less than a great society. A great society was more than an affluent society. It was also a good society, a place where men are more concerned with the quality of their goals than the quantity of their goods. Said the president, "The great society rests on abundance and liberty for all. It demands an end to poverty and racial injustice, to which we are totally committed in our time." The day after Kennedy's assassination, Johnson met with Walter Heller, chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers, and told him that, contrary to his reputation as a conservative, he was not one. "If you look at my record, you would know I'm a Roosevelt New Dealer. As a matter of fact, to tell the truth, John F. Kennedy was a little too conservative to suit my taste." In his first address to Congress on November 27, 1963, he urged action on civil rights. "We've talked long enough in this country about equal rights," he said. "We've talked for 100 years or more. It's time now to write the next chapter and to write it in the books of law." Johnson always said that his slogan was, "He gets things done." He wanted to further Kennedy's agenda, and he had his own agenda, an unconditional war on poverty, which he announced in his first State of the Union address in January 1964. Johnson once told reporters, "When I was young, poverty was so common that we didn't know it had a name." But as Galbraith had pointed out in the affluent society, poverty hadn't been eradicated. It had only been forgotten. Few things are more evident in modern social history than the decline of interest in inequality as an economic issue, Galbraith wrote. Inequality has ceased to preoccupy men's minds. Some of the poor were far away from the cities and the suburbs. One-fourth of those who lived below the poverty line worked on farms. In the Kennedy administration, the war on poverty had its origins in January 1963, after Kennedy read a long essay by Dwight MacDonald in The New Yorker, "Our Invisible Poor." No piece of prose did more to make plain the atrocity of poverty and an age of affluence. Prosperity, MacDonald argued, had left the nation both blinded to the plight of the poor and indifferent to their suffering. There's a monotony about the injustices suffered by the poor that perhaps accounts for the lack of interest the rest of society shows in them, MacDonald wrote in a scathing indictment of the attitude of the American middle class toward those less well off. Everything seems to go wrong with them. They never win. It's just boring. Heller had given Kennedy a copy of MacDonald's article. In February 1963, the entire text of the article had been entered into the congressional record. Johnson, leveraging the nation's sympathy for the martyred president, pressed Congress for legislation. The next year, he signed the Economic Opportunity Act and the Food Stamp Act. He believed poverty would be eradicated within a decade. He had more ambitions, too. Wrangling congressmen like cattle, as ever, he secured the passage of the Civil Rights Act, which outlawed discrimination based on race, color, religion, sex, or national origin, gave the Attorney General power to enforce desegregation, allowed for civil rights cases to move from state to federal courts, and expanded the Civil Rights Commission. No memorial oration or eulogy could more eloquently honor President Kennedy's memory than the earliest possible passage of the Civil Rights Bill for which he fought so long, Johnson said in a canny piece of political rhetoric. Both Martin Luther King and Malcolm X went to Washington to watch the congressional debates over the Civil Rights Bill, a rare bringing together of the two men. Malcolm X had fallen out with the leadership of the Nation of Islam. He'd mocked the August 1963 march on Washington, but disobeying the explicit orders of Elijah Muhammad had attended anyway. In December, he'd answered reporters who asked him to comment on Kennedy's assassination, despite specific instructions from Muhammad not to speak on the subject. He said Kennedy's assassination sounded to him like chickens coming home to roost. Muhammad had ordered him to withdraw from all public activity, but in April 1964, having advocated that black men arm themselves, he delivered in Cleveland a speech called The Ballot or the Bullet, in which he argued that revolution required elections. That vantage brought him to the halls of Congress. The congressional debates that Malcolm X and Martin Luther King watched revealed fractures within both parties, the Democrats challenged by their southern flank and Republicans by their right flank. "I'm not anti-Democrat," Malcolm X said. "I'm not anti-Republican. I'm not anti-anything. I'm just questioning their sincerity." The point is, he said, the time had come to vote. The debates also revealed the worst of American political chicanery. Southern Democrats filibustered for 54 days. Strom Thurmond said that the so-called civil rights proposals, which the president has sent to Capitol Hill for enactment into law, are unconstitutional, unnecessary, unwise, and extend beyond the realm of reason. A segregationist from Virginia, Howard Smith, introduced an amendment adding the word sex into the bill, a proposal so ridiculous that he was certain it would spell the legislation's defeat. But after Maine Republican Margaret Chase Smith's spirited defense of the amendment, it passed, a momentous, if ironic, achievement in the battle for equality for women. Meanwhile, George Wallace, running for the 1964 Democratic nomination, did surprisingly well in the early primaries. On the campaign trail, he heard from white voters whose expressions of deep-rooted racial animosity were part of a white backlash that would only gain force. At a Wallace rally in Milwaukee, a man named Bronco Gruber said about the city's blacks, "They beat up old ladies, 83-year-olds, rape our womenfolk. They mug people, they won't work, they're on relief. How long can we tolerate this? Did I go to Guadalcanal and come back to something like this?" Wallace's bid for the nomination was ended, not by Johnson's popularity, but by the entry into the race of a conservative Republican. Barry Goldwater, a far-right conservative Republican from Arizona, voted against the civil rights bill, making clear that he did so on constitutional grounds alone. "If my vote is misconstrued," he said, "let it be, and let me suffer its consequences." Supporters of the bill eventually broke the filibuster, and on July 2, 1964, Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act into law. 11 days later, the Republican National Convention met in the Cow Palace in Daly City, California, and nominated Goldwater as its candidate for president. In 1960, Goldwater had published a ghostwritten manifesto, The Conscience of a Conservative, that had become a bestseller. His positions at the time occupied the very margin of American political discourse. He called for the abolition of the graduated income tax and recommended that the federal government abandon most of its functions, closing departments and diminishing staffs at a rate of 10% a year. Goldwater also opposed the Supreme Court's decision in Brown v. Board, insisting on states' rights, a position that aligned him with Southern Democrats and also with John Birchers, whose goals included impeaching Earl Warren and withdrawing the United States from the United Nations. Their leader, Robert Welch, had gone so far as to suggest that Eisenhower might be a communist agent. Some Birchers believed Sputnik was a hoax. Birchers especially hated Kennedy. Right-wing radio commentator Tom Anderson said in Jackson, Mississippi, "Our menace is not the Big Red Army from without, but the big pink enemy within. Our menace is the KKK. Kennedy, Kennedy, and Kennedy." Conspiracy theorists who believe Eisenhower was a communist looked like an easy target. And some Kennedy advisors, including Arthur Schlesinger Jr., had urged him to tie the Republican Party to the John Birch Society. In 1961, Kennedy began talking about the right wing of the GOP. Daniel Bell in the New American Right had argued that the right wing was fighting nothing so much as modernity itself. Moderate Republicans, too, had energetically attacked Goldwater. New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller warned that a lunatic fringe might subvert the Republican Party itself. A matchup between Kennedy and Goldwater would have been interesting. Kennedy, who'd had much success debating Nixon in 1960, had apparently agreed to debate Goldwater if he won the Republican nomination in 1964. Goldwater later said that he and Kennedy had planned to cross the country together, debating at every whistle stop, without Madison Avenue, without any makeup or phoniness, just the two of us traveling around on the same airplane. But Johnson had no reason to agree to debate Goldwater, whose chances of winning the nomination seemed remote. Rockefeller, vying with Goldwater for the nomination, painted him as a Nazi. In fact, Goldwater had Jewish ancestry. Liberals said much the same. "We see dangerous signs of Hitlerism in the Goldwater campaign," said Martin Luther King. At the Republican National Convention, Margaret Chase Smith, who sought the nomination herself, the first woman to run for a major party nomination, refused to release her delegates to Goldwater in order to prevent him from gaining a unanimous vote. Richard Nixon did not share Chase Smith's principles. He'd run unsuccessfully for governor of California in 1962, and having lost 2 elections in 2 years, he was in no position to seek the presidential nomination himself. Nevertheless, he set up a clandestine campaign, headquartered in a boiler room in Portland, Oregon. He considered his options. He toyed with running. He toyed with joining the moderate GOP's Stop Goldwater campaign. And he toyed with supporting Michigan Governor George Romney. When he finally concluded that he had no chance of beating Goldwater, he threw his support behind him. Accepting the party's nomination, Goldwater defended himself against the charge of extremism in language that lost him what little support he might have hoped to enjoy from party moderates. "Extremism in defense of liberty is no vice," Goldwater said, "and moderation in the pursuit of justice is no virtue." Rockefeller and Romney refused to campaign for Goldwater. Nixon, with his eye on 1968, exerted himself tirelessly. He gave 156 speeches on behalf of the party nominee. Johnson was tickled. "In your heart, you know he's right," was Goldwater's slogan, to which Johnson's campaign answered, "In your guts, you know he's nuts." Or, alluding to Goldwater's enthusiasm for deploying nuclear weapons, "In your heart, you know he might." Goldwater had campaigned for a constitutional amendment to guarantee Bible reading and prayer in public schools. But Johnson, who had broad support among evangelical Christians, made sure Goldwater had little success with that constituency. Days before the election, Billy Graham's followers urged him to throw his support behind Goldwater, sending him more than 1 million telegrams and tens of thousands of letters. Johnson pounced. "Billy, you stay out of politics," he told Graham in a phone call, and then invited him to stay the weekend in the White House, far from his mail. In November, Goldwater lost to Johnson by more than 16 million votes, winning only his home state of Arizona and 5 states in the Deep South. So catastrophic was the loss that GOP leaders attempted to purge conservatives from leadership positions within the party. That meant purging conservative women. Goldwater's nomination had been crucially supported by Phyllis Schlafly, a former kitchen cabineter who was president of the National Federation of Republican Women. Born in Missouri in 1924, Schlafly would become one of the most influential women in the history of American politics. During the Second World War, she'd worked as a gunner, test-firing rifles in a munitions plant to put herself through college, after which she'd earned a graduate degree in political science from Radcliffe. A devout Catholic, she'd been an ardent supporter of McCarthy. Her husband was president of the World Anti-Communist League. In 1952, she'd run for Congress under the slogan, "A woman's place is in the House." In 1963, Schlafly had nominated Goldwater as the speaker at a celebration of the 25th anniversary of the Federation of Republican Women's Clubs. During that celebration, she'd also taken a straw poll. Out of 293 Federation delegates, 262 chose Goldwater as the party's nominee. Conservative women had flocked to the Goldwater campaign's crusade for law and morality, and to Mothers for Moral America, a fake grassroots organization that recruited Nancy Reagan to its board. But while conservative women had supported Goldwater, the mainstream of the Republican Party had not. The 1964 presidential election was the first in which as many women voted as men. They also voted differently than men. Overall, across parties, women were even more likely to vote against Goldwater than were men. Goldwater Republican women, it seemed, were out of touch not only with the party, but with the country. After Goldwater's ignominious defeat, Ellie Peterson, a Michigan party chairman and Romney supporter, set herself the task of keeping Schlafly from the presidency of the National Federation of Republican Women at its next election. "This proved difficult," Peterson said, "because the nut fringe is beautifully organized." Schlafly was narrowly defeated, but she contested the results, and police had to remove women from the convention floor when they began attacking one another. The dame game, Time said, had become altogether unladylike. Schlafly was not so easily defeated. She would never have called herself a feminist, but she believed women should be helping to lead the GOP. "Many men in the party frankly want to keep the women doing the menial work, while the selection of candidates and the policy decisions are taken care of by men in the smoke-filled rooms," she complained. The book she wrote about her ouster includes an illustration of a woman standing at a door labeled Republican Party Headquarters by a sign that reads, "Conservatives and women please use servants' entrance." 3 months after she was kept from the presidency of the women's arm of the GOP, she began writing a monthly newsletter, waging her own crusade for law and morality. It would take her years, but in the end, she would retake the Republican Party. Lumbering Lyndon Johnson, flushed with victory, decided to use his 16 million vote margin to shoot for the moon. He had a big Democratic majority in the House, what's known as a fat Congress. He knew his mandate wouldn't last. Just by the way people naturally think, and because Barry Goldwater has simply scared the hell out of them, I've already lost about 3 of those 16, he told his staff on January 1965. After a fight with Congress or something else, I'll lose another couple of million. I could be down to 8 million in a couple of months. Johnson headed what political scientists call a unified government, in which the executive and legislative branches are controlled by the same party, as opposed to a divided government, in which one party controls the White House and the other Congress. Unified governments and divided governments have legislative agendas of roughly the same size, but unified governments, unsurprisingly, are more productive than divided governments. They get more of their bills passed. Still, no unified government in American history was as productive as LBJ's. Johnson, who'd begun his career in Washington in 1937, understood the nature of political power better than nearly every other American president. He met with leaders of Congress every week for breakfast. He called senators in the middle of the night. He cajoled, and he threatened, and he made trades, and he made deals. He got Congress to pass an Education Act, providing millions of dollars to support low-income elementary and high school students. He convinced Congress to amend the Social Security Act to establish Medicare, health insurance for the elderly, and Medicaid, health coverage for the poor. Care for the sick, and serenity for the fearful. And he then flew to Independence, Missouri, so that Truman could witness the signing. "You have made me a very, very happy man," said a deeply moved Truman. The flurry of bills was hardly limited to social reform. Johnson also persuaded Congress to pass a new tax bill, a tax cut that had been introduced into Congress before Kennedy's assassination, the largest tax cut in American history. He hoped it would relieve unemployment. Instead, it undermined his reform programs. It was as if he'd cut off one of his own feet. "I want to turn the poor from tax eaters to tax payers," Johnson said, selling his tax cut to Congress. In this formulation, recipients of social programs like Aid to Families with Dependent Children, AFDC, created in 1935, and Medicaid, created in 1965, were the tax eaters. Recipients of other kinds of federal assistance, Medicare, veterans benefits, farm subsidies, were the taxpayers. By making this distinction, 1960s liberals crippled liberalism. The architects of the War on Poverty, like the New Dealers before them, never defended a broad-based progressive income tax as a public good in everyone's interests, nor could they separate it from issues of race. They also never referred to Social Security, health care, or unemployment insurance as welfare. Johnson's Council of Economic Advisers told him that when explaining how a government might fight poverty, he ought to avoid completely the use of the term inequality or the term redistribution. The poor were to be referred to as targets of opportunity. At first, the tax cut worked. People used the money they used once to pay taxes to buy goods. In 1965, Time put Keynes on the cover and announced, "We are all Keynesians now." But as with everything Johnson did, his economic reforms were demolished by his escalation of the war in Vietnam. When Kennedy died, Robert Kennedy had pressed Johnson not to abandon Vietnam, which had been Johnson's inclination. By the spring of 1965, Johnson had come to understand that he couldn't withdraw without losing, and he didn't want to lose. "I am not going to be the president who saw Southeast Asia go the way China went," he said. In March 1965, the United States began to bomb North Vietnam. That spring, Johnson committed to ground forces. But because he didn't want to abandon his domestic agenda, he decided to conceal the escalation. He lied about American involvement, and his administration lied about the war itself. By the end of the year, there were 184,000 troops in Vietnam. College students managed to avoid the draft. Disproportionately, American troops in Vietnam were poor whites and blacks. Johnson deliberately hid the cost of the war. Eventually, paying for the war would require raising taxes. To postpone that inevitability for as long as possible, he cut funding for his social programs. "That bitch of a war," he later said, "killed the lady I really loved, the Great Society." Even as the president insisted that this is not Johnson's war, this is America's war, protesters chanted, "Hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today?" Johnson, elected in a landslide in 1964, would be so unpopular by 1968 that he'd decide not to run for a second term. and liberalism would be so shattered by Johnson's compromises, by the rise of the New Left, by race riots, by the anti-war movement, by white backlash, and by the right's calls for law and order, that Nixon would gain the prize he'd been eyeing since his days on the high school debate team in Whittier, California, the White House. 4. There are more Negroes in jail with me than there are on the voting rolls, read an ad placed in the New York Times by the Southern Christian Leadership Conference while Martin Luther King was in prison in Selma, Alabama. Civil rights workers had been trying to register voters in the Deep South for years without much success. Still, the spirit of protest had spread. In 1964, Mario Savio, a 21-year-old University of California philosophy major, spent the summer, the Freedom Summer, registering black voters in Mississippi. When he got back to Berkeley that fall, he led a fight against a policy that prohibited political speech on campus by arguing that a public university should be as open as a public square. The same right was at stake in both Mississippi and Berkeley, Savio said, the right to participate as citizens in a democratic society. After police arrested nearly 800 protesters during a sit-in, the university acceded to the students' demands. The principle of allowing political speech on campus was afterward extended from public universities to private ones. Without this principle, students wouldn't have been able to rally on campus for civil rights, or against the war in Vietnam, or for or against anything else then or since. But the fight for a democratic society divided the left. When the civil rights movement turned its attention from desegregation to voting rights, it splintered. The fight for voting rights also hit a wall within the Democratic Party. Contesting the Democratic Party's all-white delegation to the party's nominating convention, SNCC set up an alternative party, the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. Ella Baker ran its Washington office and delivered the keynote speech at its state nominating convention in Jackson. At the Democratic Party's August 1964 convention in Atlantic City, party leaders refused to seat the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party delegation. Stokely Carmichael decided to give up on party politics. Carmichael, who'd been a freedom writer in 1961, graduated from Howard University in 1964 with a degree in philosophy, and was nominated for a senior class humanity award for his work registering voters in Mississippi. He'd been arrested half a dozen times. "The liberal Democrats are just as racist as Goldwater," he concluded. Borrowing the word black from Malcolm X, Carmichael urged a new militancy. "If we can't sit at the table," said one leader of SNCC, "let's knock the fucking legs off." King and the SCLC still favored working with white liberals. SNCC increasingly favored black consciousness and black power. Selma would be their last stand together. In January 1965, 100 years after Congress passed the 13th Amendment, Johnson delivered his inaugural address in Washington, and King went to Selma, where demonstrators had pledged to march all the way to Mississippi, a 55-mile journey that would take them through a county whose population was more than 70% black, where hardly any African Americans had so much as attempted to vote since the rise of Jim Crow. On March 7, 1965, they met 500 Alabama state troopers stationed on the far side of the Pettus Bridge, ordered by George Wallace to arrest anyone who'd tried to cross. Malcolm X, who'd by now been denounced by the Nation of Islam, flew to Selma. Though SCLC leaders worried that he'd incite violence, he spoke in support of the protesters. Only weeks later, his house was firebombed in New York, and on February 21st, he was assassinated in Manhattan by three men from the Nation of Islam, armed with pistols and shotguns. He was shot 10 times, once in the ankle, twice in the leg, and 7 times in the chest. "I disagreed with him," James Baldwin said, deeply shaken. "But when he talked to people in the streets," he went on, "if one ignored his conclusions, he was the only person who was describing, making vivid, making a catalog of the actual situation of the American Negro." Johnson, pressured by the televised spectacle of Alabama state troopers cracking the skulls of civil rights marchers in Selma as they repeatedly tried to cross the bridge, addressed Congress on March 15th. "At times, history and fate meet in a single time, in a single place, to shape a turning point in man's unending search for freedom," he said. "So it was at Lexington and Concord. So it was a century ago at Appomattox. So it was last week in Selma, Alabama." Calling on Congress to pass the Voting Rights Act, he closed with his trademark Texas twang. "And we shall overcome." King, watching in Alabama, fell to weeping. The week before Johnson sent Congress the Voting Rights Act, he'd sent Congress the Law Enforcement Assistance Act, saying he wanted 1965 to be remembered as the year when this country began a thorough, intelligent, and effective war against crime. The creation of the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration, which funded 80,000 crime control projects, vastly expanded the police powers of the federal government. For some time, it has been my feeling that the task of law enforcement agencies is not really much different from military forces, namely to deter crime before it occurs, just as our military objective is deterrence of aggression, the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee said during hearings over the bill. After Johnson signed the act into law, his administration opened a war on crime, a war in which the police were empowered to act like a military force using helicopters to patrol city neighborhoods and computer simulations to anticipate crime. Money that had gone to cities for anti-poverty measures was used to fight crime. After-school programs and teen centers, instituted as elements of the war on poverty under Johnson, would come, under Nixon, beginning in 1969, to be run by police, elements of the war on crime. More Americans would be sent to prison in the 20 years after LBJ launched his war on crime than went to prison in the entire century before. Blacks and Latinos, 25% of the U.S. population, would make up 59% of the prison population, in a nation whose incarceration rate would rise to 5 times that of any other industrial nation. Dismantling the parts of Johnson's program that were aimed to provide services to children and teenagers, Nixon would leave intact only the parts of the program that were aimed to punish them. Running the Great Society became the work of police. Block grants for urban renewal were used instead to build prisons. James Baldwin said, "Urban renewal ought to be called Negro removal." On August 6, 1965, Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act into law. But the quiet that Johnson had anticipated did not come. The next day, the House Committee on Education and Labor held hearings in Los Angeles's Will Rogers Park Auditorium to find out why the city had failed to implement federal anti-poverty programs. 1,000 people came. The hearings turned into a rally. 4 days later, riots broke out in South Central Los Angeles, in Watts, the first in a series of riots that would shock the nation over 4 long, hot summers. King flew to Los Angeles and preached nonviolence. No one really listened. The population density in the city of Los Angeles outside of Watts was 5,900 per square mile. In Watts, it was 16,400. The uprising lasted for 6 days and nights and involved more than 35,000 people. 34 people were killed and nearly 1,000 injured as the streets burned. Army tanks and helicopters turned an American city into a war zone. LA Police Chief William Parker said that fighting the people of Watts was very much like fighting the Viet Cong. Johnson asked, "Is the world topsy-turvy?" Watts, a neighborhood twice the size of Manhattan, had not a single hospital. An affluent society, Watts was an indigent society. From the outside, it looked as if rights had been answered with riots, as if the entire project of liberalism were collapsing on itself. Each riot over those 4 summers stood alone, but each began with police violence in a segregated neighborhood in a northern city, where there were hardly any jobs, where the houses were falling down, where the right to vote hadn't ended anyone's misery. In Newark, the biggest city in New Jersey, where the population was 65% black, 18 babies had died in the city hospital in a single year of diarrhea in a hospital infested by bats. And yet, arguments that the federal government had failed cities like Newark were met with objections. The federal government had spent more on anti-poverty programs per capita in Newark than in any other northern city. Violence begat violence. In the riots that began in Newark in the summer of 1967, police brutality led to protest, which led to looting, which led to shooting. A 4,000-strong force of National Guard sealed off 14 square miles of the city with roadblocks. In the scenes broadcast on television screens across the country, Newark looked to some American viewers like Vietnam, a mayhem of snipers, of civilians slaughtered. A week and a half later in riots in Detroit, more than 7,000 people were arrested and more than 2,000 buildings destroyed before order was enforced by 9,600 paratroopers from the 101st and 82nd Airborne Divisions. That summer, a headline on page 1 of U.S. News & World Report read, "Is the U.S. unable to govern itself?" Conservatives had an answer. They could govern with a will of iron. Ronald Reagan, 55 and running for governor of California, declared the riots the result of the philosophy that in any situation the public should turn to government for the answer. Liberalism caused the riots, Reagan suggested, and only conservatism could end them. Reagan, a man of charm and grace as dapper as a groom, grew up in Illinois, the son of a shoe salesman who supported his family during the Depression through the largesse of the New Deal. Young Reagan, an ardent Democrat, memorized FDR's speeches, those intimate, confident fireside chats. After graduating from a Christian college, Reagan began working as a radio broadcaster and sports announcer. He turned to film in 1937. During the war, he made films for the Office of War Information. A reliable B-movie actor, widely trusted, in 1947 he was elected president of the Screen Actors Guild, where he was an anti-communist crusader. In 1952, he began supporting Republican candidates. He registered as a Republican in 1962, and by 1964, supporting Goldwater, he'd become a Sunbelt conservative, convert to a new cause. Other politicians rallied, Reagan wooed, in a half-hour televised endorsement for Goldwater, a speech called A Time for Choosing. Reagan's promise as a politician all but oozes out of the screen. For Reagan, the issue in the 1964 election, as in every election afterward, was a recasting of Alexander Hamilton's question in Federalist 1 in 1787. Reagan asked not whether people can rule themselves by reason and choice instead of accident and force, but whether we believe in our capacity for self-government, or whether we abandon the American Revolution and confess that a little intellectual elite in a far distant capital can plan our lives for us better than we can plan them ourselves. Not reason versus force, but the people versus the government. Conservative and moderate Republicans didn't agree on much, but they did agree that liberalism was to blame for the violence. King had cried at the end of the march from Selma to Alabama. How long? Not long, because no lie can live forever. In 1966, college football star Gerald Ford, then the House Republican leader, turned that how long around, asking, how long are we going to abdicate law and order, the backbone of our civilization, in favor of a soft social theory that the man who heaves a brick through your window or tosses a firebomb into your car is simply the misunderstood and underprivileged product of a broken home? Reagan went further. Working men and women should not be asked to carry the additional burden of a segment of society capable of caring for itself but which prefers making welfare a way of life, freeloading at the expense of more conscientious citizens, he said, inciting a racial animosity that came to be known not as backlash, but white lash. To run his 1966 gubernatorial campaign, Reagan had hired the California political consulting firm of Spencer Roberts. The heyday of Whitaker and Baxter had ended. Whitaker died in 1961. But Spencer Roberts used the Whitaker and Baxter rulebook. You know something, Stu? Reagan said to Stuart Spencer, politics is just like show business. You begin with a hell of an opening, you coast for a while, and you end with a hell of a closing. On the stump, Reagan found a new target, college students. He complained about undergraduate malcontents, and as election day neared, he made a point of publicly denouncing invitations issued by students at the University of California, Berkeley, to two speakers, Robert Kennedy, who was slated to talk about civil rights, and Stokely Carmichael, who had been asked by the Students for a Democratic Society, SDS, to deliver the keynote address at a conference on black power. We cannot have university campus used as a base from which to foment riots, Reagan warned. He sent a telegram to Carmichael, urging him to decline the invitation, suggesting that the appearance in Berkeley of the head of SNCC would stir strong emotions, a clever way to guarantee that Carmichael would come. The FBI, which had been conducting illegal surveillance on and waging campaigns of harassment against hundreds of civil rights activists, including Martin Luther King, had opened a file on Carmichael in 1964, accelerating its collection in 1966 when he started talking about black power and police brutality and urging forms of protest later adopted by the Black Lives Matter movement. The month before Carmichael was scheduled to speak at Berkeley, a white police officer in Atlanta shot and killed a black man. Carmichael organized a protest and spoke at a rally that led to 2 days of unrest. An FBI informant in Atlanta sent an encrypted telegram to J. Edgar Hoover. Carmichael believed Negroes should form vigilante groups to observe police, and should any acts of police brutality be observed, a committee should be formed among the Negro element to press such matters. Carmichael was charged with inciting a riot. Hoover stepped up surveillance of what he described as black nationalist hate groups. Released on bail and challenged by Reagan, baited by Reagan, Carmichael headed to California. Reagan had by now made his opposition to the free speech movement the centerpiece of his gubernatorial campaign, promising to crack down on Berkeley's noisy, dissident minority. Urged on by UC Regent H.R. Haldeman, Reagan talked about student unrest day after day, much to the dismay of his campaign manager, who told him that the issue hadn't left a trace in the polls. "It's going to," Reagan promised. 3 weeks before the election, Reagan's campaign advised him that his prospects would improve if the disorders boil into public prominence again. Carmichael's proposed visit offered Reagan the opportunity to tie his campaign against student protesters to his denunciation of black militancy. After Reagan issued a public call to Carmichael not to come to California, he asked his opponent, the incumbent governor, Pat Brown, to join him, knowing that Brown would refuse. Carmichael played right into Reagan's hands. "This is a student conference, as it should be held on campus," Carmichael, 25, lean and grave, told a crowd of 10,000 Berkeley students. Echoing Frederick Douglass's 1860 plea for free speech, Carmichael said that the regulation of speech amounted to a struggle over whether or not black people will have the right to use words they want to use without white people giving their sanction. With Carmichael and the New Left, the civil rights movement changed course. "We've been saying freedom for 6 years and we ain't got nothing," Carmichael said in Berkeley. "What we're going to start saying now is black power." SNCC's H. Rapp Brown, who called LBJ a white honky cracker, said, "John Brown was the only white man I could respect, and he is dead. The black movement has no use for white liberals. We need revolutionaries. Revolutions need revolutionaries." Huey Newton, a founder of the Black Panthers, cited Chairman Mao, "Political power comes through the barrel of a gun." Reagan won in a landslide, and in the congressional midterm elections, 27 of the 48 Democrats who'd been swept into office with LBJ in 1964 failed to win re-election. Republicans won 9 out of 10 new governorships and gained control of state houses across the country. But the 1966 election wasn't so much a victory of Republicans over Democrats. It was a victory of conservatives over liberals. Goldwater's star fell. Reagan's rose. The conservative standard-bearer, Reagan was the first national figure to bring the intensity of the Cold War to domestic politics. He served 2 terms as governor, held on to his conservative convictions, and bided his time while his party moved rightward. He set as his agenda nothing short of dismantling the New Deal. From the California governor's office, Reagan didn't let up on either the rhetoric of law and order or his denunciation of free speech on college campuses. In May 1967, when the California legislature was debating a gun control measure, 30 Black Panthers, led by Bobby Seale, walked into the California State House armed with magnums, shotguns, and pistols. "Black people have begged, prayed, petitioned, demonstrated, and everything else to get the racist power structure of America to right the wrongs which have historically been perpetrated against black people," Seale said. "The time has come for black people to arm themselves against this terror before it is too late." Reagan, who went on to sign the law, told the press he saw no reason why on the street today a citizen should be carrying loaded weapons. Johnson called for a National Advisory Committee on Civil Disorders to investigate the riots. Chaired by Governor Otto Kerner of Illinois, the Kerner Commission issued a 426-page report calling for $30 billion in urban spending and, as conservatives read it, essentially blaming whites for the violence in black neighborhoods. The commission recommended spending more money on public housing, instituting a massive jobs program, and committing to desegregation of public education. Kerner and his colleagues warned that failing to change course could quite conceivably lead to a new kind of urban apartheid, with semi-martial law in many major cities, enforced residence of Negroes in segregated areas, and a drastic reduction in personal freedom for all Americans, particularly Negroes. Except for a recommendation about expanding urban policing, Johnson ignored it. With every instance of racial unrest, with each new form of public protest, Reagan's political capital grew. "Free speech does not require furnishing a podium for the speaker," he said in 1967. "I don't think you should lend these people the prestige of our university campuses for the presentation of their views." Later that year, black students at San Jose College, led by a dashiki-wearing sociology professor and former discus thrower named Harry Edwards, filed a protest against racism on campus and threatened to disrupt the opening day football game. Fearing a riot, the college president called off the game. "The first time a football contest in America has been canceled because of racial unrest," the Times reported. Reagan called the cancellation of the game an appeasement of lawbreakers, declared Edwards unfit to teach, and called for him to be fired. Edwards called Reagan unfit to govern, and 2 months later began organizing a nationwide campaign for black athletes to boycott the 1968 Olympics, beginning with an article in the Saturday Evening Post called "Why Negroes Should Boycott Whitey's Olympics," which led to the clenched-fist black power protest of 2 medal winners, the inspiration decades later for NFL protesters who kneeled during the playing of the national anthem. Meanwhile, outcry against the escalating war in Vietnam galvanized the new left and gave a sprawling and mostly disorganized movement both focus and intensity by bringing together the free speech and civil rights movements. In 1966, John Lewis announced SNCC's opposition to the war in Vietnam and its support for draft dodgers, described by Lewis as the men in this country who are unwilling to respond to a military draft which would compel them to contribute their lives to the United States' aggression in Vietnam in the name of the freedom we find so false in this country. At Berkeley, Stokely Carmichael had called on